Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble. With exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. It was common during the years of the U.S. invasion of Iraq to talk about the Sunni-Shia split and how the sectarian violence was the result of a centuries-long hatred between these two religious schools. But seeing this divide as the result of a long-standing feud, or to see it in the model of other religious schisms, like the Catholic-Protestant split and the centuries of war that followed, would be a mistake, argues Toby Matheson. Toby, in his most recent book, The Caliph and the Imam, The Making of Sunnism and Shiism from Oxford University Press, tries to chart the history of the Sunni-Shia split, its origins at the very start of Islam's founding, and how different Muslim polities, including those outside of the Arabian core, flitted between tolerance and conflict. Toby Matheson is senior lecturer in global religious studies at the University of Bristol. He is the author of several award-winning books and has previously held fellowships at the universities of Oxford, Ca' Foscari of Venice, Stanford, Cambridge, and the London School of Economics. Today, Toby and I talk about the origins of this division between the Sunni and the Shia, and how different regimes throughout history molded and were molded by this split, and what that means for the present day. So, Toby, thank you so much for coming on the show today to talk about kind of your comprehensive history of the split between Sunnism and Shiism. But perhaps I want to start by actually talking about or asking about what this split really represents. So, you know, what are the religious differences? I know there's historical and political differences that we'll get into later, but are there any, and what are the religious differences in terms of like doctrines or articles of faith between the Shia and the Sunni faiths?
Yeah, I mean, there are religious differences, but they do relate to the historic and political disagreements. So we can't really disentangle one from the other. Because after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, it wasn't entirely clear to all of his followers who should succeed him, and there was major disagreements. And by and large, Sunnis agreed that a number of his companions should become his successors, his caliphs, and another group argued that no, some of his offspring, related family should lead the community. And those would eventually become, you know, the Shia. They saw that Ali was their first imam. While, of course, the sort of the historical, you know, details are sometimes, you know, can be a bit confusing, basically, they are very significant also for the religious and doctrinal aspect because, for example, Shia argue that all the imams are infallible. So whatever they did is almost like law. Whereas Sunnis argue, no, a different set of people, the first generation of Muslims, and also to a certain extent, the first caliphs, have to be emulated. And often, actually, they did different things. And therefore, you know, the sort of two separate and different sets of of traditions to be followed, established, you know, fairly early on, and led to sort of different, different doctrinal developments as well. And I guess that's why the book is called The Caliph and the Imam, from the outset.
So, let's get into this kind of foundational split then. Who was going to be the proper successor to the Prophet Muhammad? I mean, so what's the history, as best we know, about this kind of division between these two camps?
So I just sort of started outlining this a little bit. I mean, I think one of the things to always be very aware is that actually the term Sunni and Shi'i, you know, didn't really exist or were not applied necessarily at the start as denominators for these groups. And there were also some other movements that eventually died out that had different views. So, you know, it's important not to read history backwards and sort of say that, well, there was an unchanging Sunni and Shi'i community from the start that somehow, you know, is represented today. There were always sort of, you know, fluctuations and conversions and people could join, you know, this or that group. But ultimately, that sort of, you know, early historical disagreement, as I said, led to, you know, the different legal schools, the Sunni and the Shi'i ones, having sort of different ways of coming, for example, to legal rulings, or also coming to rulings about, you know, how to behave and about how to practice your faith. Of course, you know, many key core things are the same. So Sunnis and Shia accept the same Quran, for example. That's a very important thing. But on the second source of Islamic law, on the Hadith, so the tradition, in a sense, of the Prophet, and his companions, there is major disagreement, and that then leads to, you know, different interpretations of these two sources. So in Shi'ism, you have a much stronger sort of position of the imams, and then eventually of the Shi'i clergy. Whereas in Sunnism, you had a stronger sort of development of legal schools that then, you know, once they had sort of devised specific rulings, people applied, you know, relatively unchanged over the centuries. So,
So then how does this kind of this split play out in the early centuries of Islam? I think you write in your book, is like there's actually a lot of tolerance happening. There's a lot of kind of this division isn't really quite as stark as it seems today, you know, to use your point about not reading history backwards. But then how does this kind of division between the two camps kind of really kind of play out in these early centuries?
I mean, I think one of the things that struck me also in writing the book is that actually, you know, you do have in the different periods already, very strongly political projects that that seek to employ, you know, one side or the other, or a specific sub-school to basically legitimize political rule, to give the rulers a specific sort of almost divinely ordained status, and also differentiate these rulers from competitors domestically or neighbors, and then sometimes also legitimize war against them, because in principle, Muslims shouldn't go to war with another Muslim power. So, claiming you actually are the correct Muslim power always legitimized that. And I think, yeah, so you know, the major argument I think of the book is sort of the political nature of this disagreement, but then also the ways in which it was instrumentalized throughout history. I mean, I think one of the ways in which the earlier periods are different from later ones, especially sort of, you know, also from the early modern period onward, is that, you know, you had, let's say, in the 9th, 10th, 11th century, 12th century, you had already sort of, you know, Muslim dynasties, espousing one, Ismaili Shi'ism, and then, you know, going against the other groups, or a Sunni sort of very, very Sunni-centric identity and denouncing Shi'ism. but it never really applied to all the population under the rule of this particular dynasty. So to a large extent, you know, people could go about their daily lives and their religious lives unmolested, even when, you know, at a sort of big power level, there was already a sort of sectarianized rivalry going on. So, for example, the Fatimids of Egypt, there were an Ismaili Shi power that very strongly sort of, you know, tried to spread Ismaili Shiism also in, you know, very far away, all the way to India. But, you know, most of the population under their control basically didn't convert to their particular interpretation of Islam. And when they were overthrown, their legacy, sort of their religious legacy, slowly disappeared. And so I think in that sense, sort of the earlier period differs from what we have sort of from the early modern period onwards. And especially sort of in more recent history.
So I want to ask about the Safavids, who I think end up establishing kind of one of the, I think arguably one of the earliest and I guess few Shia powers in the Middle East. I wonder if you might kind of talk a bit more about the Safavids in Iran and maybe kind of the version of Shiism that they followed.
Yeah, so exactly. The Safavids would be an example of a new power that actually did things quite differently. I mean, they started out as a Sufi movement and actually sort of straddled the lines between, you know, normative Sunnism and Shiism. And then, you know, but sort of in the 15th century started to espouse, you know, a sort of pretty radical form of 12 Shiism and used that to mobilize people and to eventually take over Iran, and that was actually a very personalized sort of Sufi form of Shiism, in which the Safavid ruling family were sort of the spiritual leaders as well. But, you know, once they had conquered Iran, they brought in clerics that were more formally trained in a more scriptural 12 Shiism from you know, Arab countries where Shiism had sort of remained, you know, continued to exist, and they staffed sort of the legal institutions, you know, part of the state bureaucracy, and they were instrumental in basically a top-down conversion of Iran. So over the next two centuries, you basically have a conversion of Iranians from you know, Sunni Islam or you know, Zoroastrianism or you know, other you know, or a sort of more, you know, not so specifically aligned religiosity to Shiism. So you know, what we know today of Iran as sort of the heartland of Shi power is due to the Safavids, really. And in their case, it was quite different. They started to you know, expel populations that didn't want to convert. They had sort of, you know, enforcers in the streets. So Shia prayer times differ a bit from Sunni ones. So they, you know, you had to go and pray at the you know, Shi hours. The call to prayer, you know, was specifically referring to Ali. And that was instituted. And, you know, while some Sunnis survived, and there are still Sunnis today in Iran, most had to convert or leave the country. And this was a rupture. But you know, it weren't only the Safavids. It was at this time that also other powers started to act, you know, more like this, in the sense that, you know, they adopted a more specifically you know, confessional or sectarian, you know, interpretation of Islam, and then try to apply that more strongly, you know, to their populations under their control.
Another region you talk about, which I think often gets kind of left behind, I think, when talking about the history of Islam, is India and kind of Mughal India. How do these discussions about Sunnism and Shiism play out in South Asia?
Yeah, precisely. So India is actually another big topic of the book, and has really added, I think, a lot to my own understanding of Islamic history and to debates that are sometimes more Middle East centric. So you know, when the Safavids come to power, you actually have direct reactions in India. So in the Deccan, there are the Deccan Sultanates, and one of the rulers there actually, sees the Safavids as an example and also converts to 12 Shiism and tries to do sort of the same, try to do a sort of a top-down sort of, you know, propagation of Shiism. Then his neighbors are very upset, you know, also for dynastic reasons, but ostracize him as being a Shi and an ally and, you know, with other sort of local Sunni rulers. And so you know, that is, for example, a very direct consequence. In other forms, you know, the sort of Iran as the center, in a sense, of the Persianate world, Persian becoming sort of the main lingua franca of Central Asia and South Asia, I mean, the Muslim part of South Asia at the time. So the Safavid takeover exerts incredible influence also in sort of Persianate circles in Afghanistan and in northern India. And you have there also quite strong conversions to Shiism, and while the Mughal dynasty and sort of the main ruling dynasties remain Sunni, you have quite a strong influence of Shiism, and the Mughal reign is often seen as a more sort of ecumenical polity, obviously. You know, the Muslims remained a minority in almost all places, and therefore, you know, always had to accept religious difference. There was no other way around it. But, you know, the ways in which they linked themselves to Iran, you know, especially the Shia linked themselves to Iran, and, Sunnis in Mughal service, for example, those that had come from Afghanistan, for example, linked themselves more to sort of Afghan rulers that were actually fighting the Safavids and had a very strong sort of Sunni identity. It's in these ways that that India also became very much connected to these sort of more sectarianized rivalries that were playing out in the Middle East and Central Asia.
I want to ask I want to ask kind of another big picture question before kind of, again, returning to the history. I think when a lot of lay people think about religious schisms and religious divides, I think the model that comes to mind is probably, you know, Catholicism versus Protestantism, which led to centuries of war. And I mean, obviously, most religious schisms aren't like that, but I think that's kind of the model a lot of people have in their heads, is that, you know, these differences of doctrine lead to a lot of violent conflict. But what's a better way of understanding, kind of these conflicts or debates or coexistences with the Sunni and the Shia populations?
Yeah, you're right at pointing this out. And, you know, myself, I've been asked this countless of times at talks or you know, conversations and so on and so forth. And I actually discussed this a little bit in the book as well, because sort of the, you know, in sociology of religion, it's very much informed by studying the Catholic-Protestant split and the very language that people use. And then also started to use for other religions comes from this. So the notion of church versus sect, right? So the very term sect and sectarianism, which is sometimes used to describe these issues, comes from the Christian context, but doesn't make sense in Islam. And I think that's, you know, one of the things I discuss at the start of the book, and then also later on. I really try actually to avoid the term sect, because in the Muslim case it doesn't make sense. As we just discussed, you know, the split happened right after the death of the Prophet, and you know, for 1,400 years, you know, the two sides sort of developed you know, their own sets of practices, legal schools, religious traditions, but also, you know, sets of books and ways of a clergy. And so it's really different from, you know, the Protestant sort of movement against the Catholic Church, you know, much later in the religion's history. Sometimes, you know, it has been argued that, or one could make the case that, you know, the only thing that is sort of comparable in Christianity would be the split between the Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church, for example, or, you know, the relationship between the Catholic Church and all the Middle Eastern, you know, the churches, basically. That also doesn't encompass really, you know, in a sense, I mean, that would be similar in the longevity of the relationship. But, you know, you did have in Christianity then a sort of, you know, an integration almost of some of these churches into the Catholic Church, or at least a rapprochement. And you never really had that with between Sunnism and Shiism. I mean, I discussed some of it in the book, but what is really crucial here is that, so in the 18th, 19th century, when European empires start to conquer much of the Islamic world, especially India that we just talked about, and then, you know, there were big Sunni and Shi populations, and, you know, the East India Company started to implement a legal system and so on and so forth, and started to draw up, you know, well, what are the, you know, what are the Muslim law that we should apply here, and started to draw up Sunni and Shi legal texts and tried to, you know, started to translate it and so on and so forth. You know, the early Orientalists, Orientalism being that sort of, you know, academic discipline, so-called academic discipline dealing with everything in the Orient, they started to translate sort of the first sort of, you know, religious texts and also histories of Islam they could find, and most of the things they translated and engaged with early on came through the Ottoman Empire or from India, and many were actually sort of Sunni works and that were very polemical against the Shia. So you had quite, you know, early on, you had then the notion that, well, the Shia are the sect in a sense of Islam. And for quite a long time, this actually perpetuated a sort of a very biased view of Shiism in Islamic studies, or, you know, also in more popular perceptions of Islam and histories of Islam in the West, really. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is also to counter that and take, you know, the different branches of Islam sort of at face value. How would they describe themselves? How do they, you know, how do they see themselves? And there you see that obviously Shia don't see themselves as a sect. They see themselves, yes, they're the minority branch of Islam, but they see themselves very much at the heart of Islam. And I think there were some mistakes made in the past, and we really need to be very careful, basically, when we try to sort of, you know, invoke something like the Catholic-Protestant split. Having said that, however, in the 16th century, you know, as we have just been discussing, we see sort of similar processes happening in the Islamic world that are happening in Europe. But I think they're more to do with sort of broader world historical patterns rather than sort of, you know, doctrinal specific, the spillover of the Catholic-Protestant split. So, you know, for example, the Ottomans, you know, start to have this big rivalry with the Safavids, and that legitimized themselves more as a sort of a Sunni Muslim power. But this comes in context with their rivalry with the Habsburgs, you know, where they actually also are sort of forced to become a sort of a more Muslim power against the sort of Christian legitimized Habsburg power. So there are these sort of connections between Europe and the Middle East and Central Asia here. But we need to also be aware of not overstating sort of the similarities.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Well, that's an interesting segue to kind of my next question, which is kind of as we start moving into kind of the latter half of the second millennium, where you start to see, you know, Sunnism and Shiism getting wrapped up in concepts of national identity or proto-national identity. I will ask how European empires get involved. Maybe let's stick with the identity question first. How does kind of these proto-national and national identities then start getting wrapped up in discussions of Sunnism and Shiism as well?
Well, because in let's say most countries nowadays that have a sort of a Muslim majority, you know, a certain interpretation of Islam, like anywhere in the world, you will have a sort of a majority religious group, and their symbols, their narratives will have been interwoven with nationalism in one way or another, even if that is done, you know, more explicitly in certain cases, and even if there was a, you know, very strong secularizing nationalism at some point or another. But sort of, you know, historic narratives, you know, epic battles or, you know, foundational figures, they will inevitably be bound up with a sort of a state, you know, state religion, in a sense, and you know, preferential treatment for one religion over or one interpretation of religion over the other. It's something that is happening, you know, all over the world in a sense, and the Islamic world is no different, but it hasn't really been studied in so much depth. So there's one chapter that looks at this more specifically. So, you know, obviously, you know, Shiism becomes Iran's national religion. There's no way around that. And yet there was a sort of very, you know, secularizing nationalist interlude in a sense with the Pahlavi dynasty. But even there, you know, there was some support for religion and Shi institutions continued. And nowadays, you know, in places like Turkey or Iran, or Pakistan, which sort of sees itself as the successor or you know of the all of the Mughal and the sort of the, you know, Indian Muslim dynasties, you have that very strong connection between national identity and territory and a sort of an early modern Muslim empire that sort of, you know, gives meaning, but that also espouses particular confessional identities. And I think in those places where actually, you know, where there were contestations in the past and people perhaps converted from one to the other, this is particularly sensitive. So you know, Egypt, right, is considered a heartland of Sunnism in many ways. I mean, has a big Christian population too, but sort of the history of that sort of Shi, of the Shi founding dynasty in a sense of Muslim Egypt, means that, you know, when there are instances of conversions of Egyptians to Shiism, for example, there is a lot of outrage and this can be instrumentalized very much because it actually constitutes a sort of a separate, you know, political historical project that has some resonance. And you do see that also in places like Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, or the Gulf states, where Sunnis and Shias sometimes have a bit of a different a different nationalist view, or, you know, a different view of what constitutes the ideal nation, what constitutes the symbols, and so on and so forth. The same with the remaining Sunnis in Iran, actually have a sort of a different set of nationalism from the majority. So I think, you know, this intertwinement in a sense of nationalism and confessional identity in Islam is a fascinating topic.
I do want to ask about kind of the West's role in this, and how the West kind of interacts with these two different religious schools, I guess is the word I'm going to use, given that other words are potentially problematic. But how does the West kind of get involved in this, whether through empire or maybe in the post-empire stage? How does the West kind of interfere in this?
It's crucial. So the book has four parts. Now we talk mainly about sort of the first two parts, and then part three is almost, you know, entirely sort of about the colonial influence, basically, and how the colonial state reshaped religion and institutionalized really the division between Sunnism and Shiism, especially in India, but then also in other places. So this was especially important for the British and the French imperial projects, because they ruled territories where large, you know, Sunni and Shi populations were. In other parts of the Islamic world, other divisions were instrumentalized, but in, you know, in these places it was the Sunni Shi split, and therefore I mainly focus on the French and the British experiences. It was crucial, for example, in creating a legal category of Sunni and Shi that is different. For example, in the Muslim, in the Ottoman Empire, you know, there was only ever Muslim as a legal category. There was never the different, you know, different Muslim religious groups. They were never able to come to court and say, well, I want, you know, my inheritance to be regulated in a different way because I'm a Shia or I'm an Alevi or something. This only existed for all the, you know, all the Christian groups and Jewish communities in the Ottoman Empire, a sort of specific legal system. And the Ottomans always resisted this very strongly, to open up the category Muslim to subdivisions. But this was actually something that missionaries and sort of European powers and Iran, frankly, Qajar Iran pushed for. But in India and then later on in the Gulf and in the Mandate period, the interwar period in Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, the colonial powers basically created these different legal categories for Muslims and institutionalized separate legal systems for them. They even, you know, made censuses where you had to tick a box: are you Sunni or Shia or Ismaili, or in the case of Syria and Lebanon, are you Alawite, are you Druze, and so on and so forth. So basically created these categories, which, I mean, of course, some people subscribe to, but they were never put on paper like that. And so there was a reinforcing of these identities in relationship with the modern state, with the modern colonial state. So in that sense, this was incredibly important. And I guess, you know, if you refer to sort of the West in a sense as also the American interventions in the Middle East, then this was of course incredibly influential. So the American invasion of Iraq really sectarianized the whole region and allowed a lot of these sort of past histories that I talked about and also talked in the book, but that had somehow, you know, waned in importance in many places because they had been subsumed by, you know, other issues. The Israeli Arab conflict obviously was very high on everyone's agenda, other struggles, the Cold War, many other things that were much more important to people. But the invasion of Iraq really, you know, and sort of, you know, at the heartland of the Sunni Shi split and sort of the early, you know, empires and dynasties, the ascent of Iraqi Shia really played on the fears of Sunnis everywhere in the Gulf, in Egypt and the Levant, and really brought a lot of these sort of, you know, let's say more hidden conflicts now, or hidden, you know, memories in a sense, to the fore and changed the face of the whole region.
Yeah, this is actually, I think, a good place to kind of for my final question, I kind of wrap things up. You know, in your introduction, you kind of tut-tut a lot of the commentators who are writing around the time of the invasion of Iraq, but also, I guess, during the Arab Spring, that would often kind of refer to tensions between the Sunni and the Shia, sometimes violent tensions, as the result of quote unquote ancient hatreds, which I think is as you note quite a simplistic way of putting it. But obviously, as you note in your last answer, a lot of this has been kind of brought back to the fore with the rise of a Shia led state in Iraq, but also kind of these tensions around the Gulf. In the present day, as we're kind of thinking about the Middle East and kind of inter-community tensions, what in your view is the best way now to really understand this this difference between Shiism and Sunnism? If ancient hatreds is wrong, and it very likely is wrong, what's a better way of understanding this in the present day?
I mean, ancient hatreds is wrong, as I point out, but on the other hand, you know, it does have a long history, but there were specific moments, often, you know, times of political crisis or interstate rivalry where it came to the fore. So, it didn't just emerge out of nowhere. And there were very strong periods when Muslims came together, the pan-Islamic movement, or for example, support for Palestine. I mean, as we're speaking, these events are unfolding. One of the counter examples, in a sense, to having a Sunni alliance and a Shia alliance is Iran's long-standing support for Hamas, basically Sunni Islamist organization, and that Sunni Islamist organization accepting support from the the world's foremost Shi Islamist power. So the fact that actually Islamism in some ways emerged also as a pan-Islamic project, even if it then sort of descended in many places into violence between Sunni and Shi Islamists. But I think we really need to take the political context into account and realize that states often drive this and clerics to a certain extent, because they profit in a sense from having their position reinforced. But they are also the ones who can put a lid on religious violence. And in the last few years, this is actually what we've seen. We've seen actually a decreasing of tensions, not least to a sort of a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf and the other some other Gulf states and Iran, and really changes inside Saudi Arabia, because the spreading of the Wahhabi school, which was maybe the most anti-Shi school in Sunnism all around the world, really had a strong impact on Sunni-Shi relations all around the world. I mean, made it much worse in many cases. And the suppression of the Wahhabi school in Saudi Arabia is it's hard to overestimate the importance of this. We don't yet really know where this experiment is going, but definitely for the moment, you have much less sort of, sectarian hate speech being promoted in Saudi Arabia or by allied movements or organizations. And, both sides actually do try to refrain from provoking each other, on a religious level. I mean, there might still be conflicts, or there are still, civil wars and some wars are still going on, where the two sides sort of back opposite forces, like in Yemen. But on the other hand, we have much less now of this sort of hyper sectarianized rhetoric that we saw, for example, when with the rise of ISIS. ISIS really played on the notion of Sunni solidarity and against the West and against the Shia, and invoked messages from the Wahhabi school to basically legitimize mass killings of Shia. And that resonated with some, but also went too far, I think, especially for the Gulf rulers and the Gulf states and then the systems, because they also started attacking, right, Saudi Arabia as a state. So, we do have a betterment of the situation. Also, key clerics have come together to sort of, issue statements and issue joint conferences to say, well, the violence has really become too much. So in a sense, at the moment, due to sort of political considerations, we're seeing definitely a toning down of these tensions. But perhaps to go back to you asked about the parallels with the Protestant Catholic or with other with this conflict, what we've never really had is there were many Sunni Shi'i dialogue initiatives like at high level in, for example, in the 50s, 60s and more recently, but we've never really had full acceptance of Shi'ism, for example, as a fifth school of law, and a full sort of merging of the two sides, like a full acceptance of, let's say, the senior clergy of all the schools sort of coming together and saying, well, you have a different view on all of these things, but basically you're also a Muslim. And so I think until we have that, sort of a real rapprochement also sort of on the religious level, it will always be possible to instrumentalize this again if tensions resurface.
Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Toby Matheson, author of The Caliph and the Imam, The Making of Sunnism and Shi'ism. Toby, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, first of all, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And question two, what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Thanks. I think this book can be found in quite a lot of places. It was published by Oxford University Press, and I published two other books. One is a sort of a shorter account, written in a more vivid and immediate style about the Arab Spring protests in the Gulf and how the Gulf states sort of reacted to it, and another book on Shi'ism in Saudi Arabia, which was my PhD, which maybe I don't recommend for everyone to read. But they can be found wherever books, I think, can be ordered or found. And now I'm working more broadly sort of on the rise of the Gulf states, sort of on the modern history of the Gulf states, also on, the changing nature of religion in the Gulf states. How they have sponsored various forms of Islam, but also how they became sort of the new centers of the world. And I'm probably going to write a book about this. And I'm also interested sort of in the role of religion and the rise of political Islam during the Cold War period. So somewhat related to what we've been talking about, but, also sort of, new topics, or in a sense for me going a little bit back to the Gulf states where I sort of started my career.
Well, I look forward to hearing more about him. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all of your podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Arati Prasad, author of Silk, A History in Three Metamorphoses. But before then, Toby, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me, Nick. It was a pleasure.